Hello and welcome again to the Case for Conservation podcast. The main modus operandi of this podcast is to ask some of the more contrarian questions in nature conservation for the purpose of building a more robust and credible case for conservation. This episode is a bit different, although we do get into some of the less trodden ground as well, but it's about pursuing a career in conservation. Why would anyone want to do so, and why do some groups of people seldom do so? I can't think of anyone better to discuss this with than my guest, Nick Askew, who is founding director of Conservation Careers, an organization dedicated to helping people find work in this field. Nick and I actually recorded another conversation before this one, which will go out on his podcast, the Conservation Careers podcast. And that one is an interview about my choice of conservation as a career. So for anyone who's interested, please check out the Conservation Careers podcast. And Nick has a whole archive of interesting interviews with interesting people on his podcast as well. So I strongly recommend having a look at that, especially if you or anyone you know is interested in switching to or starting a career in nature conservation. So before we get into the real meat of it, I wanted to just ask a little bit about you personally and starting off with how you became interested in conservation as a career.
I guess my passion and interest in nature conservation started as a teenager. So I used to spend my weekends fishing, so spending the time beside rivers and lakes in the UK with my brother and his friend. Trying often unsuccessfully to catch fish. And what fishing does is allows you and creates one of the best excuses ever to just sit in a beautiful place for quite a long period of time, not doing an awful lot. I think we call it mindfulness nowadays, but really that's what fishing is, more than anything else, really. You just sit in a place and interact and hope to interact in a really close way with nature. And during my time on the riverbanks, I think I just grew a great appreciation for fish. Also, the birds that flew past, I wanted to try and name the kingfisher and the long-tailed tit and whatever else it might be, and the dragon, the damselflies and the butterflies and the plants. And really that immersion just, made nature really important to me. That was where my pleasure came from. So it sort of big one from fish became other things. Naturally, at school, I was really interested in biology, and I did biology as a degree at university, and it allowed me to specialize in ecology, so the kind of the ecological, the wildlife aspects of the biological realm. And whilst at university studying that, I also, off to one side, I got quite involved in the local the conservation volunteer group, the York University Conservation Volunteers, we call ourselves. And I sort of ran that group for 3 or 4 years. And what we did at the weekends, we would go out and we would spend our time on local nature reserves. So building boardwalks, digging ditches, making bird boxes, whatever needed to be done, really, as a group, an army of students, we just turn up, get our hands dirty, and get stuck in. And I just absolutely loved every aspect of that. I loved being outside. I loved being with people. I loved sort of interacting with the wildlife that we saw on some of these really lovely nature reserves that we had around York as well, and still do. And through that, I think the connection was made to my then best friend, a guy called Craig Ralston, who managed a lot of the local nature reserves. And together we realized that that particular area was very important for barn owls, and probably the most densely populated area in Europe for barn owls, this species that have been slowly disappearing from the UK landscape since, well, the 1930s, really, and agricultural intensification. And it just sort of at the right time, really, kind of came along this population of birds that I was really interested in, that I had access to through Craig and through the local farming communities. And so that then led into a PhD where I studied, well, why is this particular population so important? Why is it thriving? What's unique about this landscape that we can learn about this population, we can learn about, which we can then apply to other populations, you know, across the UK to help the species to recover. So, yeah, so basically, in short, in a few words, it's fishing, ecology, barn owls. And then from then on in, you know, the last 20 years of working as a professional conservationist has kind of flowed, really.
And so when you started, when you were doing undergrad, did you already know that you wanted to do conservation sort of all the way through to postgrad? Or did you sort of, was it through those experiences that you sort of adjusted your studies?
Yeah, it was. I think it was through the first year or two of my degree. And partly the experiences I had, you know, with wildlife as part of the volunteer group, that immediately told, you know, it spoke to me. This is what I love to do. I couldn't be happier when I was doing that. But also through the lectures, you know, in the first year of a biology degree, the one I took, you covered all aspects of biology. So it would have been like cell biology, you know, genetics, conservation, just genetics, not conservation genetics, you know, and then they had some sort of like ecology type modules too. And it was immediately obvious to me that ecology was the bit that interested me, you know, and the other stuff I just found less interesting. As a result, I struggled with a bit more, you know, it was just less intuitive to me. So immediately my degree allowed me to specialize. So I think those aspects all came together, and I was sort of a natural fit for the kind of the more natural sciences end of the biology spectrum. Yeah.
And then after you studied, how did your career path lead to where you are now and running an organization which helps other people to pursue conservation careers? What was the path up to there?
Yeah. So I did my PhD and I realized that I enjoyed it. It's fantastic training. Basically, you know, PhD 4 or 5 years of being paid to do a job that gives you a good qualification at the end and for you to be a specialist in a certain thing. And if you choose it wisely, you might love that thing and therefore have a great few years doing it. It's not right for everyone, but I say I really loved it. It was great. But I also realized at the end of it that I wasn't really cut out for academia. And the academic route. I didn't want to go off and do a postdoc and become a lecturer or something else. There were people around me that were just perfect for that and are still in that. Actually, you know, my friends from back in the day who are now off having a very successful academic careers, but that wasn't right for me. I wanted to explore other options. And I think a lot of people get to the end of a PhD, and some people, perhaps like myself, sort of you do a degree and then you may or may not do a master's and then you do maybe a PhD, and part of that is just through inertia, like you don't know what else to do, you're just sort of stuck within the academic route. It's quite a sticky area, you know, hard to extract yourself from. Anyway, I left, and I remember leaving having no idea what I was going to do next, but I just said, this isn't for me. And I happened to find, you know, my now wife at the time, and she was living in another area of the UK. So essentially I just up sticks, moved down to be closer to her and started job hunting locally around the area. So total happenstance. And the first job that I secured was as an ecological consultant working for quite a big multinational organization. So I was a very small cog in a very big wheel. And some aspects I really loved. I would be out in the field a lot doing surveys for species, which is what I love doing. I was working with people. It was relatively well paid as some of the jobs go. I had a good training program. So I was getting, you know, project management skills and all sorts of stuff. So it was making me be a better person and paying some debts off and getting me into the field. But after a year or two of that, I realized it wasn't really aligned to what I wanted to be doing. You know, I felt like I was just working for the man, really, and not really delivering wildlife conservation through what I was doing at the time. I mean, ecology consultancy does deliver great conservation benefits, and it is a great career path for a lot of people, and we help people into that as a great path, particularly for graduates and people like that. But at the time, it just didn't suit me, and I think if I had a different experience, it may be different now. So I just sort of kept searching. So I sort of worked in academia. Through academia, I also worked in the civil service for the government for a year, as a year in industry. Then at this year in sort of corporate consultancy, I then flipped again and worked for a charity for the best part of 10 years called BirdLife International. And BirdLife International, the world's biggest partnership of conservation organizations, working in about 120 countries around the world with one partner in each country, essentially representing that country as a local NGO. There's a couple of exceptions to that, but that's basically how it's set up. And my job was first in communications and marketing. So I was promoting BirdLife International. I was writing news stories and press releases and managing their website and that sort of stuff, which I had no background or training in, but I had a passion for. And I'd done a bit of writing and a few bits and bobs during my degree and PhD that helped me there. And the topic was something really close to my heart, bird conservation. So, you know, it's very well aligned to what I was doing. From there, staying within BirdLife, I moved overseas, actually, and this sort of connects very closely to where I am now, actually. So I moved over to the BirdLife Pacific Secretariat. We were living and working out of Fiji, and my role was to be a program development manager, which essentially was a fundraising role. So I would help to develop projects and programs across the Pacific region for our partners across seven Pacific countries. Invasive species work, marine conservation, seabird work, local community-based forest conservation projects, that sort of stuff, and species-specific projects. I would help to develop those projects with the partners. I would then develop the proposals, pitch them to donors, you know, to secure and seek the funds for, and then the conservation staff on the ground would then implement. So that was sort of the middleman there, if you like, connecting donors to projects. I had, you know, a great 2 or 3 years doing that. And again, personal reasons, really, you know, my wife and I decided to move back to the UK, start a family, as you do. And that was also a time for me to reflect and think, well, what do I want to do next? And I've always had a real interest in enterprise, actually, in kind of, you know, in environmental enterprise and in kind of creating my own enterprise, solving problems, that sort of stuff. It's sort of like, I guess, entrepreneurial interest. And I wanted to kind of start my own thing. And I thought, what can I do? And through my career, lots of people have asked, how do I get a job as a wildlife conservationist? And you must have been asked that many times. You know, lots of people in this industry do. There's lots of people wanting to work in it. And I just felt, and this is 7 years ago, eight years ago now, there should be better support, training, advice for people wanting to dedicate their working lives to wildlife conservation. So that sort of became the obvious place for me to kind of to land. I felt like I'd had quite a twisty career across lots of different areas, doing lots of different types of job. I felt I understood the pros and cons of the sectors and the jobs that are out there, and wanted to help people to navigate those options to speed up and provide clearer career paths for people into conservation. And really, that's where the idea of conservation careers came from. And that's, so 7 years and a couple of weeks to the day, really.
One thing I'm curious about is, what are the scope of careers in conservation? In a recent podcast that you did, you mentioned that there were 15 different categories, and I won't ask you to name them all necessarily, but I'm just curious. I mean, I could give a my own opinion of what, you know, how they could be categorized, but I'd probably miss out some things and clump some things that you wouldn't. So could you give us an idea, especially to those who are perhaps new to the topic, what the spread of careers is as you would define it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, firstly, you know, how do you define a conservation job? We define, you know, a conservation job as a job where your activities aid the conservation or enhancement of wildlife. So if you're working on conserving a reef in Fiji and working with the local communities there, for instance, you're a project officer working for the Wildlife Conservation Society or something like that, on the coal face, the cutting edge, if you like, of delivering conservation on the ground, that clearly is a conservation job. But if you're sat back in the office and you're the fundraiser or the communicator, you know, or a support staff, I guess, for that delivery on the ground, then that still is a conservation job. You know, you're helping to deliver those activities, you know, and I put your job into that too, Andre, you know, and I put my job into that too. I'm not out actually helping barn owls anymore or doing that active stuff, but certainly my activities are aiding that movement. And through that lens, then the conservation industry is a very big, broad, diverse sector. There are more jobs available than most people realize. It's not just helping turtles and owls and lions and everything else. And it's not just studying and researching them as well. And I mean, we've shared, for instance, on our website, over 30,000 conservation jobs over the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. And it's still the tip of the iceberg. So, you know, part of what we're trying to do is just showcase the breadth of opportunities that are out there, you know, so people can understand that there's a role for many different types of people, and we need lots of different types of people, you know, in this movement to make it happen. I do actually have the 15 job types in front of me. I don't know how interesting it would be for me to rattle through them, but I can do it really quickly just to kind of show the sorts of things that we talk about. So in kind of alphabetical order, really quick. So like, you know, animal welfare, so caring for animals is an area of conservation. So whether that's zoos, sanctuaries, rehab centers, there's lots of jobs and opportunities within there. Communications and marketing, so raising the profile of conservation is really important. I mean, one of the most important communicators and conservationists on the planet is Sir David Attenborough, you know, and there are many other examples of people like him who really, you know, are important in this movement. Community-based conservation, helping people to be part of the solution. So whether that be in a developing country, working with, you know, local indigenous communities or even local volunteer groups, you know, local to yourself in a developed country, even, you know, lots of, and that's a really a growing area of the movement. Involving, you know, and something we might talk more about actually through this podcast, you know, involving local communities, local people more, because they are needed and they are important stakeholders. Number four, countryside management, wardens and rangers. So, you know, saving the key sites for species, for nature. So working at particular sites, you know, hands-on stuff, a bit like the volunteer stuff I did as a student, but, you know, the professional end, the paid end of that spectrum. An area that's often overlooked, number five, is like ecotourism, you know, and helping people to experience the natural world whilst also benefiting it, you know, at the same time. I mean, there's good examples of good ecotourism, examples of bad ecotourism. That's something that I'm also working in at the moment as well, trying to help people sort the wheat from the chaff within that sector. But it is, you know, it's a professional industry. It employs people who definitely benefit wildlife and provide value to local wildlife on the ground, you know, through that. And it's something that I think people should kind of keep in their radar, particularly if they have like a wanderlust and enjoy travel. Number six, ecological consultancy. So ensuring ecological sensitive development. We talked about that previously as well. Number seven, environmental economics and ecosystem assessments. Probably something quite close to your heart, I would think, Andre, in terms of like putting a value on nature and talking to different stakeholders, so businesses, governments, things like that, understanding the long-term benefits of protecting nature for its intrinsic value, and also the value to us as humans. Environmental education, number eight, sticking with the E's. So increasing awareness and support for nature through education activities. Next up, what I was doing in the Pacific, fundraising and development. So raising money to save nature. So beyond promoting, which is the comms and marketing, actually now the actual raising of the money, which may involve campaigns and other things, but a lot of proposal writing, donor relations, maybe events, that sort of stuff. Number 10, a specific skill set in its own right is like mapping and geographic information systems, GIS. So putting nature on the map, and something where, you know, as we're collecting more and more data about the natural world through drones and satellite imagery and all these other technologies that are coming on, which are georeferenced, you know, we need experts who can understand, interpret, analyze, you know, and interrogate those data, you know, in quite, you know, vast sizes nowadays. And then the last five are marine conservation, so protecting a blue planet, a sector in its own right, covering loads of different job types in its own right. In fact, covering all the job types we're talking about here today, marine conservation. It's just the wet bit. But there are some specific job types that sit within marine as well. So we could sort of, yeah, we could sort of talk about that a little bit as well. But that's sort of a theme and a job type too. And the last four, photography and filmmaking. So there are opportunities, particularly as freelancers, to work and to benefit conservation efforts through those skills. And again, Sir David kind of pops out again as a good example of that. But, you know, with YouTube and Netflix and other access to big audiences nowadays quite quickly, then there are opportunities for people now doing that. Policy and advocacy, something again close to your heart, Andre. So saving wildlife through the law, through policies, through strategies to deliver them. There is a real need for experts and expertise within that area, and something we've talked about just previously before this podcast too. Last two then, 14 is program and project management. So, you know, saving the world one project at a time, a program being a collection of projects, sort of viewing it that way, you know, and there are particular skill sets required for people to be good program or project managers, and there are jobs specifically around that. And then the last one, last by no means least, science and research. So sort of answering the key questions to tackle biodiversity loss So using the kind of scientific method, scientific rigor, you know, to answer questions. Okay. So that kind of shows the sort of the breadth of opportunities of 15 different sort of pillars. There's lots of crossovers within that. It's just the way that we categorize and think about them. But on our site, when we've published 12,000 different job titles, you know, so you can sort of see that this is quite a nuanced area, and there are places, you know, that have overlap within all these things.
And do you ever get approached by people who know that they want to pursue a career in conservation, but they don't know which of these areas they want to delve into? I mean, how do you advise someone like that?
Absolutely, yeah. And really, that's what we specialize in doing, to be honest. Yeah, is trying to demystify this quite large, diverse sector and helping people to navigate and make good decisions personally within that. So there's a few bits to this. When we think about sort of strategies in terms of trying to secure employment within a competitive arena like conservation, you know, if you think about it as like a going into a competitive environment, think about it like going to the Olympics and trying to secure a gold medal, particularly in terms of securing that first paying conservation job, which is the hardest one. So if you were, say, going to go to the Tokyo Olympics just down the road from you next year, hopefully COVID willing, and to try and secure a gold medal, there's two approaches. You can be a generalist. You can go for every event that's out there, 40, 50 different events, thinking, well, I'm giving myself 40 or 50 chances of a gold medal, and therefore I'm bound to get one of them, you know, sort of, you know, throwing lots of balls at lots of coconuts, hoping one of them will fall off. The problem with that approach, and it's the same in the a competitive job hunt like conservation, is you're up against people who have specialized, who have found their niche in the earlier stages of their career, you know, something that suits them down to the ground. So from an Olympic metaphor environment, thinking like Michael Phelps, the famous swimmer, most decorated Olympian of all time, he's got the perfect body size and shape for swimming. He's got great big arms, great wingspan, long torso, short legs, big lungs, and he's trained really hard for that event that suits him really well. It's very hard as a generalist to compete against someone like that. And in a way, it's the same in your job. Finding your niche, the place where you're going to be really happy, is going to give you that competitive edge, because you can understand what employers are looking for that chosen job. And you can understand where your employability gaps might be. You've got some things they're looking for, but bits you don't. Well, how are you going to fill those gaps? What are you going to do that? You know, and that gets you to an employable level. And then you can put in great applications and deliver great interviews. And the whole kind of thing kind of fits together quite nicely. So your question is the exact right one. So how do people find their niche? You know, that's the challenge, I think, really, because things fall into place once you get that. We do that in conservation careers by sort of twofold, really. One is understanding, you've got to start, and this is the, I think, the foundation for success for any career, really, is understanding yourself really well. Self-reflection. Everyone's different. I mean, I'm looking at my garden right now, and there's a metaphor, a saying in gardening, which is right plant, right place. So, you know, some plants like hot conditions, some like dry, some like wet, some like, you know, sunny, some like acidic, whatever. You know, it's the same in your career. We all thrive in different careers. So you have to understand yourself first before you can find the right job for you. So what sort of person are you? You know, we have exercises that kind of lead people through this sort of stuff. What are you good at doing? Or even ideally, what are you great at doing personally? And what do you love doing? You want those two things to be combined ideally. Some people are great at doing something they hate doing. Let's not bring that in our career with us, but you might learn something from that. But let's combine the things that you love and are great at doing. In what context do you thrive? You know, do you like being outdoors, indoors, on your own in groups? Do you like using your head? Are you cerebral? Do you like using your hands? There's lots of ways of analyzing who you are and what you're bringing to your career. That we all have different causes we're interested in, the things that make our blood boil, charities we might support, that might be important to you in your career. You might love marine, or you might love earthworms, or for me, barn owls, whatever it might be. We all envisage different ideas of success about ourselves as well. So we basically, you know, step one is understand yourself, and we bring together this thing called a career compass, which just helps us to make better decisions based upon what we've learned about ourselves and our own unique abilities and superpowers. That's number one. And then the other bit is understanding the job market and your options. And we just talked about those 15 different job types, and there are, you know, five different employer types as well that all have pros and cons in terms of pay and training and flexibility and other things. So understanding that employment landscape and yourself, and you can kind of marry them, bring those two bits together. So in terms of the 15 job types, for understanding yourself, we can actually then match in and shortlist down which ones are most likely for you to be happy and successful within. And then from that, help people to kind of explore their shortlist through talking to people who are already working in those roles, through experiencing them, through volunteers or internships, and through other ways of kind of just trying to get that shortlist down even finer. So we want people to have that direction. We want people to have that niche. But we also encourage people, importantly, to kind of just to also to maintain an open mind as well and not be too blinkered and too focused. It gives you the direction. But just like you and I, you know, we've both had slightly windy careers and opportunities come along. And it's really important to be open to those opportunities. If your heart tells you something about that, that it's right, then, you know, be open to that and still say yes. So have the strategy, but also be adaptive, you know, as we go.
And would you sort of advise people to have one or two specialist directions as well as maintaining an interest and a bit of knowledge in a bunch of other fields, just in case the ones that they're focusing on don't end up being the right ones? I mean, I understand that you're saying that, you know, those ones that you're, if you're targeting, then you're more likely to be successful in the job. But if along the way you discover that one of the other skills that you haven't really been nurturing, but you've been keeping going, turns out to lead you in the right direction. Does that sound like a good strategy, sort of combining the specialist and the generalist approaches a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, there are a bunch of transferable or softer skills, which are really applicable across many, if not all, job types. Yeah. So those are sort of the foundations for, you know, career. And then within that, there are specialisms where, and that's really where your niche is focused. So when we think about the softer skills, which are useful for almost everyone to nurture.
Something like project management.
Yeah, bingo, exactly that. So project management would be very high up the list. Communications would be very high up the list. Mm. Things like people and time management would be quite high up the list. Conflict resolution a little bit, sort of less so, but yeah. But I think if you're focusing on, and fundraising, I'll put right up there too. So if you think about in terms of like almost like the project cycle, you know, can you design, fund, manage, and communicate about conservation projects? Those skills, no matter which area you go into, are likely to be beneficial to you as an individual and make you more employable. So those are the sorts of things I think to nurture, you know, alongside trying to find that niche, that place that's going to make you happy. Ultimately, that's what you want from your career, and that's what a niche will give you.
Mm-hmm. And presumably, you don't get people coming to you asking how they can make lots of money out of conservation. It's a passion-driven profession generally, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. It is. Yeah. I mean, people don't get into conservation because they're going to be, you know, financially wealthy. Mm-hmm. That's not this sort of driving motivation. You get into conservation for the purpose and for the impact and knowing that what you're doing is making, you know, this planet a better place. Mm-hmm. That said, you know, conservation is, you know, we're not on the breadline. You know, we're still living very comfortable, happy lives, and some roles are better paid than others. So, you know, if pay is important, you know, that's something we help people to kind of to understand and reflect about themselves. You know, I have 3 kids and a house and a mortgage and all that sort of stuff. You know, money is important. There's nothing wrong with that. I think people often feel guilty in conservation by thinking about money, and it is important. It's right. You raised the question. Yeah. So, you know, there are jobs you could choose, you know, that would pay more. Consultancy would be one, ecological consultancy. So working for corporates, some government type jobs and international agency jobs would pay better than others. Working for charities are bound to pay less than, you know, than other jobs. You can sort of navigate your options through that. And I think a really interesting area and an area which is definitely a growth area and something I'd love to see more of within the movement is enterprise, eco-enterprise. So there's nothing stopping people like conservation careers, you know, people starting their own businesses, which are sort of balancing, you know, profit and purpose, you know, because you can also, you know, deliver the best of both worlds through developing a successful enterprise. And, you know, when I think about the conservation movement, you know, charities are very much the kind of the big boys in the sector. 80, probably 90% of conservation work is undertaken by workers within a charity, and they do fantastic work. And as I mentioned, I've worked in charities myself in the past, but I think they would agree they are limited by the amount of funds that they can secure and raise, you know, from donors and other means. Mm. Whereas an eco-enterprise doesn't have that limit. Mm-hmm. You know, the bigger it can get, it can access new funds in new ways through innovative business-type models, and it provides, you know, new opportunities for creating impact within the sector. So we're seeing more and more enterprises joining the sector, and I think that's a really positive thing, and a place where, you know, people could, you know, become, you know, personally quite wealthy if they want to buy that Tesla or whatever else is important to them.
I would imagine that as, and if I'm correct in thinking that conservation and the world is moving in the right direction here, as society becomes more aware of how critical natural capital is as a form of capital, the opportunities for enterprise, as you put it, will increase over time, and perhaps the opportunities for charities to continue the way that they have been doing business will maybe sort of gradually decrease to make way for them a little bit.
I'm not sure if necessarily that would mean that the charity sector has less of a market share, thinking it like that. Mm-hmm. I think it's more like I would view it instinctively as the charity sector will still be there, still be an important part, the same, if not a bigger, you know, size. Mm-hmm. But I think it's sort of, there's a new pie, you know, thinking about that, which is this kind of business model to delivering conservation. It's like it's an additional thing, not a competitive thing.
More of a rising tide raises all boats kind of thing, I guess, you know, right. If the world does head in that direction. Nick, I wanted to just sort of change direction a little bit and ask you maybe a slightly more controversial question. And that was, I wanted to understand a little bit better why conservation careers and people in conservation are quite skewed towards the developed world. And ethnically, there's sort of a bit of a bias. I'm not sure how much of a gender bias there is these days. Perhaps you can comment on that as well. But I'm very often in rooms with, if not white males, then white people, you know, in different sort of at different stages of my conservation career, I've noticed that. Do you have any thoughts on that? So, you know, why that is the way it is, and perhaps what can be done about it?
Yeah, I think I think you describe it accurately. I think it traditionally certainly has been a white, middle class, probably male dominated sector. We're both white males talking right now, you know, and pretty fairly typical of what the sector has been like. Yeah. I think there's a lot more from a gender perspective. There's a lot more, you know, women in the sector now. I mean, I've been, you know, teaching on master's courses now for sort of 10, 20 years. And almost in every course I've taught, it's been 75% women. Hmm. Yeah. So that, and they are reaching now the tops of some of the kind of major organizations as well. So I think there's been a real influx of the gender balance. 10, 20 years from now, I think it'd be mostly women working in conservation. So that's really flipped. But from a white versus a black perspective, I think there's certainly, you know, a big discrepancy there. And from a developed versus a developing country perspective, there's a huge gap to still try and bridge, and an important one to try and do so. We need more diversity, more voices, more local voices within conservation. I mean, it's something that we're really passionate about at Conservation Careers. We've got a drive on called Celebrating Diversity in Conservation right now, where we're trying to speaking to a conservationist from every country and territory on the planet. That's our goal. I think we've spoken to sort of 30 or 40 conservationists from different countries out of 500 interviews so far. So we've got a long way to go, but we're trying to sort of spread those voices. I remember one very recent podcast episode actually we released with a guy called Anthony Ocheng, who's Kenyan conservationist known by Tony Wilde, fantastic, inspiring, passionate Kenyan award-winning, is winning awards left, right, and center at the moment. He's really doing great work. And he talked about, as a Kenyan growing up, that conservation was something that came from abroad. It was something from overseas. Mm-hmm. It was related to tourism, you know, and money, and tourists would come in, view wildlife that often the local people hadn't seen, you know, ever. They hadn't seen a lion or a tiger. They're just kept within these, you know, environments, these reserves that mm-hmm. local people can't access or see, and they're very removed from. Mm. And they didn't have access to. And he feels that, you know, conservation and wildlife, he talked about it should be as important as food on the table. This is really important to us as local people, and our perspectives, our knowledge is really important within the local context to make this a kind of sustainable movement. So there is a big divide. It is important to try and bridge. Why is it that way? Well, I guess there might be a few reasons. I don't necessarily have all the answers to that. I think partly that it's in developed, typically white countries, is because that's where traditionally the money is. That's what a developed country means, essentially. You've got a developed economy, and therefore there's more money there. And I think people tend to care more about what is closer to home than is further afield. So despite, you know, wildlife being found and many of the most important and threatened, you know, habitats being found in developing countries, that's not necessarily where the money is being spent yet by any means. And that's just because of, I think, people, you know, more care about what is close to home at the moment. So that needs to be addressed. And why do we not see more local or indigenous people involved within conservation efforts as much as we would like? I think that also boils down to money, you know, access to education, and also really when you're sort of considering priorities, you know, from a developing country's perspective, and, you know, I'm perhaps very naive in that respect, and I hope I'm not making the wrong assumptions, you know, I think wildlife conservation might be seen as a luxury. There might be greater priorities day to day than engaging in that. I mean, put simplistically, you know, food and water and other provisions might be more important than training myself or my family or my son up as a wildlife conservationist. So it's almost like a priority, a luxury perspective. And and perhaps part of that might be education, but part of that is just the local understanding, rightly or wrongly, you know. But I could certainly see an argument in that favor. I'm not sure if that fully answered your question, but there's a lot in there.
Yeah, you gave a lot in response as well. I mentioned to you when we spoke earlier that I had recently interviewed a guy. His name is Mao Amis, and he grew up in South Sudan and Uganda, and he's a conservationist now based in South Africa. And he grew up in pretty modest conditions, and the expectation of him, because I think he sort of stood out and he people could see that he was going places, so they were encouraging him to, he mentioned medicine and engineering as being the two fields that he was sort of encouraged to go in the direction of. And then really just a series of fortuitous circumstances steered him on a different course, you know, in the direction of conservation. And that's a bit of a long story, but there were conditions that would be quite difficult to recreate for anybody, you know. It was really just sort of things that happened by luck more than anything else. And I guess that perhaps it's not our place to say that people should go in the conservation career direction, you know. Who are we to say that they shouldn't be pursuing engineering and medicine, especially if it is as a way out of poverty? But I guess that in developing countries, the kind of jobs that are available are quite clearly separated in terms of income from, you know, going into medicine or engineering. Wherever you are in the world, you're going to get a fairly decent salary as a doctor or an engineer, whereas in conservation, the options are pretty broad in the developed world, and not so much in the developing world. Are you seeing more people of different backgrounds and different ethnicities, different cultures? Are you seeing that changing over time?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we help people from wherever they are. You know, we're as international as we can be, sharing opportunities and advice from, you know, from across the globe. Yes, I'm sat in the UK, my colleagues sat in Vancouver, Canada, you know, and we're kind of sharing and supporting as wide as possible. We are working with and seeing more interest actually in organizations that have become established, you know, in developing countries. So a good example of that is we're working with the African Leadership University at the moment. They have two campuses, one in Kigali, Rwanda, and one in Mauritius. And we're providing our career support and training program to cohorts of students down there. Same down in South Africa, in your neck of the woods, a great organization called Green Matters, who are supporting environmental ecopreneurs, for want of a better word, you know, across the country down there. And again, we're working with them to provide access to the Kickstarter to our training program. So we definitely see more interest at the kind of local level, and we're doing all we can to kind of support those movements and actually sort of bridge the balance between the two nations. Yeah, one thing that kind of I think relates also, I was continue to kind of think, you know, why is there an imbalance as well beyond the obvious money barrier, would be perhaps, you know, a lack of figureheads and role models within the movement that, you know, that have come from the local community level. You know, so almost everyone I ask, you know, who's your conservation hero? People say Sir David Attenborough. What a wonderful man. What a wonderful career. What an inspiring figure. But he's undeniably white, British and upper middle class. Mm-hmm. Where are the figureheads that come, that people, that local people can really relate to? The Sudanese gentleman you just mentioned and Anthony Tony Wilde from Kenya. You know, we are starting to see these people emerge, actually. I think that might help to sort of tip the balance, because without them, it's very hard for people to latch onto and even understand what is conservation and how can I get involved and why is it important. So, you know, we are, I've seen a tip into the balance there too. There's more local, yeah, local heroes, for want of a better word, mm-hmm. you know, within the conservation movement now.
Mm-hmm. And do you think there are also more opportunities happening now than there were, say, 10 years ago?
Yes, for sure. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I think you know, local indigenous charities and also international conservation organizations are getting better at doing what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So the partnerships like Fauna and Flora International, IUCN, Wildlife Conservation Society, BirdLife International, obviously I used to work for, mm-hmm. working across the globe, often establishing and or supporting, you know, locally based conservation efforts. I mean, I spoke with the chief executive of FFI on our podcast, Mark Rose, and he said his definition of success for FFI would be they're not needed anymore, and that what they've established, and I think BirdLife would probably support that, I would think as well, that really what they want to do is to stand back and let the local in-country movement sustain itself. And so with that as the goal and that as the target of many of these organizations, that is becoming increasing the way of the local effort, actually. Yeah. Mm-hmm. An issue relating to this actually is when you get, you know, local people who really show huge talent and, you know, are doing really well, is just like the Sudanese gentleman you just mentioned, tend to move, go abroad. They tend to be drawn to the international roles, moving, you know, out of their local country and going elsewhere and doing something. So it's mm-hmm. I don't really call it a talent sink, if you like. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's another challenge about trying to keep really good, talented local conservationists local.
Right.
And whether that is actually, you know, a goal or not. Yeah.
Yeah, so the brain drain phenomenon, I guess.
More brain drain, that's yeah. the word.
That guy, Mao, is his first name. He's actually based in South Africa, but the organization that he is running works across Southern and East Africa, so stretching all the way back up to where he came from. So
yeah,
he's familiar right. with the areas that he works in as well, which is good. I asked him about how conservation is working in developing countries, and he gave very interesting and nuanced answers. But one of the things that he mentioned was that there is a need for greater recognition of expertise on the ground. So you were touching on this earlier on, you know, initiatives that come in from overseas and funding that comes over from overseas, I think is starting to take much better notice of the need to bring people on the ground into the project for at least for the duration of the project, and then hopefully creating some sustainability afterwards and sort of building expertise in the process. So I expect that you're probably seeing more of that as well as time goes on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sort of community-based conservation drive, mm-hmm. that movement. Yeah, I think perhaps previously, but this is oversimplistic, but, you know, perhaps people were seen as a problem in the past, and mm-hmm. now I think local people are seen as the solution and the local partner, mm-hmm. and absolutely essential to success. Mm-hmm. You can't parachute in, say this is what we need to do, you know, and parachute out again. That the way to deliver anything is to work very closely in partnership with local communities who often, you know, really value their voice, their opinion, but also value the support they can gain from others. So good example of that would be, let's say you wanted to work, yeah, to preserve the coral reefs or forests, you know, in Fiji, something that obviously, you know, had experience of in the past. You know, to the local communities that own those reefs, they own those forests, you know, and they want to protect them. They want them to be healthy in perpetuity into the future. They want to be able to fish, you know, for the future generations, and the forest to be thriving environments too. But they don't really have alternative ways that are sustainable right now. So some of their agricultural practices, their fishing practices are unsustainable. Mm. So that's where actually, you know, outside expertise can come in, can understand, well, why are we logging the forest? Are there alternative incomes, alternative livelihoods, things we can do that maintain a healthy forest that still provide a really good income for you and your community, for kids to go to school and for you to, you know, buy the equipment you might need, you know, to live and to thrive, and for you to have the lifestyle that you deserve, you know. So, and that needs to be a partnership, you know. The people don't want to hurt their local environment. They want it to remain healthy, but that needs to be done from the outside. So those kind of people with skills to work with local communities, to enjoy travel, you know, to have, you know, lots of different languages potentially, you know, and to be very sort of culturally sensitive, it's certainly been a big drive for the last, you know, 10 or so years, and that's going to be, you know, even more so into the future.
Nick, just to end off, imagining that there's someone listening to this who's thinking of starting a career in conservation or switching, but is really sort of on the edge, you know, wondering if that's a good option as opposed to something else, perhaps something that's likely to be more lucrative, or just simply a completely different option. Any final words of motivation that you'd give to someone in that situation?
It's important, actually. I'm not here, Conservation Careers isn't here to glorify conservation as this perfect job for everyone. So actually, we're not here to push or to pull. Mm-hmm. We're just here to provide effective, honest, accurate career support. And actually, our ultimate goal is to help people to try and find the right job for them personally. And that might be outside of conservation, you know, or off to one side, you know. So I wouldn't want to push or pull anyone in any particular direction. But why would anybody want to work in conservation? For me, people choose a career in conservation knowing that your career means something, that has impact. I would love it, and I've had periods in my career when I've woken up on a Monday morning, whenever the alarm clock's gone off, like 7 o'clock, let's say, and I sort of dreaded going to work. I've not looked forward to going to the office and doing the work I'm doing for whatever reason. And actually, what I want for everyone, and something that you can find within the conservation movement, is that when that alarm clock goes off, that you're really excited, you're looking forward to that week ahead, you know, and that it fills you with a fulfillment, yeah, with a joy, you know, that what you're doing is making a deeper impact in the world, and that you've found a job that day to day, the tasks suit you and to make you happy. And for me, the conservation movement provides that in bucket loads. You know, there's lots of different opportunities here. It's a big movement. It's a growing movement. There's lots of jobs that are available. There are more people looking than ever before. We've probably touched on that already. It is competitive, so it's hard to get that first job. But the things we talked about here today, the strategies and other things about putting good applications in others, you know, can make a huge difference to getting you that first paying job, and then off you go. And with regards to career switching particularly, so if you listen to this and you're working in a, you know, what you feel is quite an unrelated job and you've always wanted to work in wildlife conservation, then it is possible to switch. You can go from what you're doing now, you only live once, that's my belief anyway, you know, and your career is 5 days out of seven every week, so it's incredibly important to you. Find the thing that really gives you purpose in life and sort of double down on that. A lot of the time you can sort of take what you've already been doing and you'll find that it is valuable within the conservation sector. You just need to find that thing. Put simplistically, if you're working for, you know, Virgin Media and you're doing marketing for them, you're probably incredibly good at marketing, you know, across all sectors, and would be very valuable and valued within the conservation movement were you to do your marketing for WWF or IUCN or whoever it might be. And they are looking for you too. They want really good professionals from the corporate sector to come in and to professionalize and take us to the next level. So don't think that what you're doing isn't translatable. More often than you would appreciate, it probably is. And that also means you don't necessarily have to go right back to the beginning again. Now, you might want to do that. You might say, you know, I don't like doing marketing. I want to do something. I want to be that warden, that ranger that Nick talked about. Yeah, that is still an option for you, but it might mean a bit of retraining. You know, it might mean some new experiences and skills needed as well. So lots of ways in, but it's a great sector and it's full of great people, actually. I mean, that's the one thing that levels, you know, we talk on our podcast to conservationists every couple of weeks. And I feel like I make a new friend every couple of weeks because we've got so much in common. And that is absolutely across the sector, you know, and people know each other too. So it feels like you're sort of joining a family, a movement that is trying to sort of fight for the better.
Okay, that's it for this episode. If you'd like to learn more about the work of Conservation Careers or to try Nick's podcast out, please have a look at the show notes for this episode, or you can check the Case for Conservation website at www.caseforconservation.com. And you can just select the episode page for this episode and you'll find those links and a few others. Next time I'll be speaking to Michelle Marvier. Michelle is a professor and associate dean at Santa Clara University in California. She and Peter Careva have been working together for many years, doing pretty much what I aim to do with this podcast. In other words, challenging assumptions and seeking a clearer picture when conservation is presented perhaps a bit oversimplistically or inaccurately. Specifically, I'll be talking to Michelle about the precautionary principle and the need to take greater risks in conservation, considering the cost of inaction in a rapidly changing world. See you then.